This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. I'm Peter Burley. Coming up, removing dams on the Snake River in Idaho might save the salmon. The proposal is causing a furor with electric power producers, irrigators, and people who use the lakes. We talk to the scientist who is discovering planets orbiting nearby stars in our ongoing series on the search for the origins of life. The aroma of fresh tortillas engulfs us from a street in the Colonia at Tijuana, Mexico. And on the Earth calendar, the pecan picking season has just finished in Georgia. It's part of the Great American Harvest. These stories and more coming up on the Environment Show. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. This spring, the Army Corps of Engineers will be making recommendations to Congress on how to proceed with salmon recovery efforts in the Snake River, which runs along portions of Idaho's border with Oregon and Washington. At the center of the issue is the impact that dams have on the fish. From Maine to Michigan, California to North Carolina, communities across the country are grappling with the question of whether dams should be removed to repair aquatic environments. But probably nowhere has it created as much tension as it has in Idaho. From Coeur d'Alene, Nancy Wilson reports.
For more than 10,000 years, ancestors of present-day Nez Perce Indians lived along the banks of the Great Snake River in Idaho. They knew the sun would rise in the morning, the moon at night, and that millions of giant salmon would return each spring and summer. Beginning in the 1960s, four dams were built along the lower portions of the Snake, the first in Lewiston, Idaho. The river was transformed from wild and unpredictable to a placid, navigable waterway. The resilient salmon, able to traverse 1,000 miles to spawn, which survived the many floods and volcanic eruptions in the Northwest geologic history, could not survive the gauntlet of these man-made dams. Today, Snake River coho are extinct, and sockeye, chinook, and steelhead salmon are extremely endangered. $1.7 billion have been spent trucking and barging salmon smolts past dams, on bypass systems, and on hatcheries, and still, fish numbers are rapidly declining. Scientists and biologists studying this issue believe the only way to save these salmon is to restore the natural flow of the Snake River, and that means removing the lower four dams, a very unpopular idea with most Lewiston residents.
There are many things that are affecting our fish runs right now, and the drastic impact of tearing out dams is kind of the silver bullet approach that if we do that, then we don't have to worry about anything else. This is a complex problem with no silver bullet solutions.
David Doringsfeld is the administrator for the Port of Lewiston. At a recent debate, he expressed fear of economic disruptions if the lower Snake dams were breached to save the salmon.
What I think this issue is about is how we're going to balance the vital issues of the Columbia Snake River system. Now, what are some of the vital uses of the Columbia Snake River? First of all, recreation, the fishing that we're talking about tonight, also boating, recreation, navigation, farmers from Idaho to the Dakotas, Montana, Wyoming that move their products through the Columbia Snake River system, irrigators, about 42,000 acres of land are irrigated out of that system, and the food processing that goes along with it, hydropower. We enjoy some of the lowest rates in the United States.
Doringsfeld believes we're blaming dams for salmon loss, while other factors are more to blame.
Now, when we talk about salmon recovery, if you've been involved in this, you're probably familiar with the four H's having to do with salmon recovery: habitat, harvest, hatcheries, and hydro. And I'd first like to look at hydro. Again, as I've stated, there's no doubt the dams have had a significant impact on salmon stocks. However, the fact that numerous coastal salmon populations are in decline is an obvious indicator that hydropower development is not the only factor of importance for successful recovery of endangered fish runs. And because the focus is completely on the dams, the hydro portion of this, the hatcheries, the harvest, and the habitat are overlooked. And I guess that's the the problem that I have right now. Yes, we need to evaluate the dams, and yes, it needs to be an issue, and yes, we need to wrestle with this. But while we're doing so, we do nothing with the other three H's. And there's areas of consensus that we could be making improvements on, but yet we don't deal with those because we're also wrapped up in what we're going to do with these dams.
Jim Baker is the Sierra Club's Columbia Basin field rep. He heads up the Northwest Salmon Campaign and is a vigorous proponent of dam breaching.
In talking about salmon recovery, I'm going to impose on myself the requirement of telling you carefully which biologists I am turning to for authority on Columbia Basin fish recovery. Now, according to the National Marine Fisheries Service, the Northwest Power Planning Council, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, the Idaho Department of Fish and Game, the Columbia Basin Fish and Wildlife Authority, and even BPA, in one ruling or another, the eight federal dams, four on the lower Snake, four on the lower Columbia, take not the exclusive, but the largest, at least 80% of the human-inflicted toll on these fish coming out of the Snake River Basin. Yes, there are no silver bullets. We must deal with all four H's, but 80% of the solution must go to 80% of the problem.
Baker states there are many ways dams destroy fish.
Now, how do these dams kill fish? Among the ways are poor juvenile passage at the dams with retrofitted bypass equipment, inefficient adult passage at the dams on the fish ladders, long travel times for juveniles and adults, lost spawning habitat, lost food chains, predators, and lethally high water temperatures.
According to Baker, because the Lower Snake dams provide only 5% of the Northwest power, the cost of retiring them for the consumer will be about $5 more on the average electric bill. As far as losing barging abilities on the Snake,
the Palouse region, where I live, built its agricultural economy on railroads and trucks. The barges and dams only came online in 1975. We can surely convert back to the tried and true railroad and truck as the principal means of shipping crops and goods to market.
And soon, Northwesterners may have to make a few sacrifices to save a magnificent fish that helped humans survive for centuries. For the Environment Show, I'm Nancy Wilson.
Take me back, oh lonely river.
Continuing our conversations with scientists who are studying the origins of life, I spoke with Paul Butler, staff astronomer at the Anglo-Australian Observatory, which is in Australia. Within the last 4 years, planets have been discovered orbiting stars, and Dr. Butler and his team have pioneered the effort. If there is life outside our solar system, other planets may well be the place to look. I asked Butler about his research.
It's kind of surprising that as of 1995, there were no known planets around any sun-like stars. And since that time, two or three research groups have found 15 total Jupiter-like planets orbiting nearby sun-like stars. Our group has found 12 of them.
And when you say planets around sun-like stars, how far away are these stars?
The stars that have been targeted are, of course, the nearest by stars are typically about 10 to 100 light years away.
And how do you find them?
How do we find them? It's impossible to directly see the planets. I mean, you've got this notion of an astronomer looking through a telescope and maybe sees the little dot of light next to the star. That kind of technology doesn't yet exist. What we actually look for is the gravitational effect the planet has on the star. As the common notion is that the planet orbits the star, Jupiter orbits the sun. In reality, though, the planet and the star both orbit a common center of mass. The star is maybe 1,000 times more massive, so the common center of mass is very close to the star. Nonetheless, the star makes a small counter orbit to the planet, Newton's third law of motion. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. And by looking for this very small counter motion in the star, we're able to infer the presence of the planet and calculate its orbit.
So how many stars now have planets that have been discovered?
About 15 nearby sun-like stars now have been found to have planets over about the last 3 or 4 years.
And do you have any inkling as to what
is on these planets or what they're made out of?
Yeah, the planets that have been found so far are all massive, like Jupiter. Jupiter is about 300 times more massive than the Earth. So the current technology is only able to find these massive Jupiter-like planets. We can guess that they're probably made of the same sort of stuff that Jupiter is, primarily hydrogen and helium.
And that then leads to the next question, are there a great many more out there?
Yeah, the technology is brand new to even be able to make these sort of detections. We're literally in the adolescent stage. NASA has plans, as well as the European Space Agency, over the next 20 years to launch much more sophisticated satellites, telescopes into space that might ultimately, within 20 years, have the ability to directly see planets, even Earth-like planets.
Now, finding planets itself, I presume, at least for some of us, is a surprise since we didn't know they were there. Or did you find surprises for yourself as you did this research?
The discoveries have been quite surprising. Prior to the actual discovery of planets, it was thought that all planetary systems would be similar to our own. Giant Jupiter-like planets in circular orbits a long way from the star, closer to the star, small rocky planets like the Earth. It turns out that of the 15 planets found, only one of them seems to be of this sort. The other 14 are quite different. They're either Jupiter mass planets very, very close to the star, much closer than the Earth's sun distance, or planets in wildly eccentric, non-circular orbits, egg-shaped orbits, which is completely theoretically unexpected.
So this tells us that these other systems are really quite different from our own.
The diversity of planetary systems is quite surprising, and I think there's a lesson here to be learned by us all, namely that extrapolating based on statistics of one, the one known system prior to this was our own, is a very dangerous game, and that nature is going to make an incredible diversity of objects. So we have to stay on our toes.
And that, I guess, has always been the problem. We always assumed that everything was like us, and now even planets are not like our own.
Yes, The discovery of planets actually is a continuation of literally of the Kepler of the Copernican and Keplerian revolutions, and the discovery that all systems are not like our own is a very powerful reminder to us that we live in a wild and diverse universe.
Now, our series has been focused on the origins of life. Tell me what your finding tells you about our own search for the origins of life.
Well, the search for planets, of course, ties indirectly into life in that we think that planets are necessary surfaces for life to even form on. So I would say the one thing that we found that's very helpful is that probably most stars have planets. We're finding planets everywhere. They're very common, and it may be the case that most stars have accompanying planets. On the downside, to the extent that we think that planets need to form on small rocky surfaces like the Earth, and in a nice water zone, these may be relatively rare. There may not be as many of these as we thought. Still, in a galaxy with 200 billion stars, there's probably millions of such places.
Now, to the extent that other systems appear to work differently than ours, would that mean possibly that life takes forms that we can't even imagine growing up in places that are so totally different from our own planetary system?
It's almost certain that that life on other planets is going to be radically different from our own. I mean, it'll have some things in common. It'll probably be carbon-based, but the forms of the life will be radically different because they'll be evolutionarily suited for that environment.
And based on your knowledge, is there any doubt in your mind that life exists on other planets in other places?
Okay, I think that if you separate that into a two-part question, the first part is, does any kind of life exist? Do bacteria exist? Do single-celled creatures exist? I would say it's inconceivable that they don't exist. It's inconceivable that there aren't rocky planets with water around stars and that at least simple life hasn't formed there. The harder question is intelligent life out there? And that, I think, is a completely open question.
I know that for years people thought life required a somewhat benign, wet system. And recent speculation and discoveries about hot vents and so on has led that to change people's outlook. Does your research lend anything to the notion that the places that life could have formed may be radically different than even those that we now speculate about?
It's quite possible. We now know that the very smallest stars, the very faint red dwarf stars, have planets, and that one can speculate about planets around these stars in very, very close distances where it's warm enough for liquid water, but the light is almost entirely infrared, and that would obviously be a radically different kind of life. But even the hot vent life still requires water. It's hot vents around water, and it seems water is the one key that we think is absolutely necessary for life.
We have been talking with Paul Butler of the Anglo-Australian Observatory, whose group has discovered 12 of the 15 known planets orbiting stars in the universe. We welcome new affiliates to the more than 215 radio stations currently carrying the Environment Show. They're KMBH-FM and KHID-FM in Harlingen, Texas. Coverage of the origins of life is made possible by NASA through the support of the New York Center for the Studies of the Origins of Life, located at the New York State University at Albany, the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, and the College of St. Rose. The Environment Show is a national production. It's made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the William Bingham Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby, www.hemmings.com. We at the Environment Show would always like to hear from you. Call us, 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. Email is green@wamc.org. That's green@wamc.org. We all have special places that touch our soul. For some, it's the deep woods. For others, it's a busy city street. For author Luis Uria, it's the home he grew up in the Colonia outside Tijuana, Mexico. In this portrait of place, Uria reads from his book titled Nobody's Son.
Our family house seemed to grow out of the hillside in Colonia Independencia. It's still there if you know where to look, though my cousin Hugo might shoot you if you show up unannounced. Hugo has his pistols loaded with buckshot instead of slugs. One time a neighborhood drunk kept disturbing his beloved throat-eating herd of Dobermans, and Hugo came out of the house and ran down the street shooting at the guy until the guy's pants were soaked in urine and he ran and begged for his life. This is the kind of joke Hugo appreciates. If you stop by, be polite. My grandfather built our house, and the house, for some reason, remained unfinished. It was a two-story, but the slope of the hill made the front door actually open on the second floor. The first floor was half subterranean and hidden. Hey, no problem. The house next door had a home-built balcony that pitched and yawed almost gently. The walkers upon it had the aspect of sailors on a small boat. Later, the entire house hunched its shoulders and leaned out of plumb. It was vaguely trapezoidal and somehow jolly for its angle. Our house had a living room and a bedroom and a dining room and a kitchen on the top first floor. There was also to be a second bedroom, but that mysterious power that stopped my grandfather never let him put it up. So the dining room opened onto a wonderful room that overlooked the canyons and bustling streets of Tijuana. There, drooping clotheslines waved the Urrea flag, giant old lady underpants. I spent much time out there shooting toy guns, watching eclipses, inspecting the arcane panties, fooling with the ubiquitous Tijuana geraniums, and spying through windows with Hugo's telescope. I often went to buy family tortillas. They'd give me money and I'd head out the door. The colonia was lively as ever every day. Aside from dogs and scruffy gangs of kids playing marbles in the dirt, ice cream men pushed his little wooden wagon selling paletas. Another man pushed the exact same wagon and sold steaming hot ears of corn. Their magic skill really involved my brain. How did one keep his treats icy while the other kept his hot? Huge water trucks rumbled through with bad boys hanging onto the backs. Brilliant kites rattled in the phone lines like slaughtered pterodactyls. The hill was jumping. The tortilleria was the world's jolliest sweat lodge. The heat was always high from the massive sheet of iron kept hot by eternally burning propane. Six or eight women worked in there all day, sweating and yelling over the sound of a radio. You could smell the holy maíz heating and sending out its incense all over the street. You could smell it from two blocks away, and the sound of their palms on the corn dough was audible from at least one block distant. Pit-pat, pit-pat. The sound lies within the heart of everyone who relied on fresh tortillas every day, a sound now replaced by heartless machinery that presses out tortilla analogs on conveyor belts. I'd stand at the counter and peer up at them, those women with all their mysteries and their laughter. Pit-pat, pit-pat. Everybody was poor, but who knew? Their arms, the richest, most enjoyable brown, jiggled as they worked. Their hair, deep black, wound into immense braids, lay pinned to their necks. They fed us all. You could hang out at the tortilleria and eat a pound of soft, hot tortillas. They'd give them to us plain, good enough. Or they'd roll a few drops of lemon juice in one, or a pinch of salt, or both. I ate a couple of these mini tacos while I waited, and then headed home with the bundle hot and pulsing comfortably against my gut. Pit-pat, pit-pat.
That was author Luis Urrea reading from his book titled Nobody's Son. It's published by the University of Arizona Press. And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. In Georgia, the pecan harvest recently concluded for another year. It's part of a great American harvest. Buddy Legier is chairman of Georgia's Commodity Commission for Pecans and co-owner of L&M Enterprises, which grows, processes, and markets the nuts. For the past 33 years, Buddy has been growing pecans on the 1,200-acre orchard in the southwestern part of the state, about 65 miles south of Macon. The harvest begins in October, and Buddy says to get the pecans off the trees, he uses a long beam with scissors-like head that attaches to the limbs.
The boom raises up and down, tilts forward and backward and side to side to where you can reach up and get a hold of the big limbs, and then you clamp the big limb, and then you put the shake in the gear, and what it is, it's you have two hydraulic motors on the head of the shaker. One of them turns you, has weights in it, and one of them turns the set of weights one way, one of them turns the set of weights the other way, creates a vibrating, trembling-like thing, and it shakes, vibrates the tree.
A harvester collects the pecans after they fall into the ground. They're then brought to the processing plant to be cleaned and graded. Buddy says some are sold at the wholesale level, while others at retail in gift packs and mail order. Overall, 1998 yielded less than half the amount of pecans Buddy normally grows in a year. A combination of warm and cold temperatures at the wrong stages of the growing season is the major reason.
But we had 100-degree temperatures May, June, July, and August. And so that took the toll on some of the nuts. And then it was dry. It didn't rain. Once it quit raining, it didn't rain anymore because we got irrigation. But irrigation is just a supplement. That's something to help you not make the whole crop by itself.
In addition, Legier lost about 80 trees due to Hurricane Earl, which resulted in more lost pecans. For Buddy, the growing season actually begins in February when fertilizer is applied to the orchard, and by May, the nutlets bloom. That's when he begins a biweekly spraying schedule to protect the crop.
You have some insects you have to spray for. We try to protect our beneficial insects to where they will take care of some of the other insects, so you don't have to don't have to spray as much for insects. That's something that's really come about in the last five or six years. So used to we didn't know about the beneficial insects, but that's what you get from research.
Protecting the leaves is important because they absorb sunlight, which enables the tree to conduct photosynthesis, the process by which trees produce food. Without photosynthesis, we wouldn't have such treats as pecan pie or chocolate caramel pecan cheesecake. Buddy says his favorite way of eating pecans is right out of the bag. Not surprising for those of us who are nuts about pecans. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, we talk green about attitudes and the environment. Do we need to think differently to keep the planet healthy? And if so, how? A green tip on how to go with the flow. And finally, will the EPA require those gas-guzzling sport utility vehicles we love to own and drive to meet strict clean air standards? Stay with us. Talking Green, and I'm Peter Burley. The Environment Show has a distinguished board of advisors who I rely on for advice throughout the year. And at the end of the year, it's been our custom to ask them to reflect on where we've been and where we're going. This year, we're going to have a series of conversations with them, each on a separate topic, with a different group of advisors each time. Today, our topic is whether there are attitudes that need to change to bring about a sustainable planet. Recent history tells us that attitudes can change. You will recall that smoking was accepted in American society a couple of decades ago, and now people think about smoking in quite different terms. Attitudes changed in Eastern Europe, and the Berlin Wall came down, something that I think none of the pundits predicted at the time. So again, the question today is whether there are attitudes that should change to help us bring about a sustainable planet. My guests are three members of the Environment Show Advisory Board. Mary Lou Reed, she is former state senator from Idaho, and she joins us from Coeur d'Alene. Jonathan Plout, former director of environmental quality for the Allied Signal Corporation and now chair of the advisory committee, which is part of the International Commission on Environmental Cooperation that was set up under the NAFTA, or North American Free Trade Agreement. And Joan Davidson, former New York State Commissioner of Parks and Historic Preservation. Welcome to you all. Welcome to Talking Green. John, I'd like to start with you, given your experience serving at the very highest level of an international, multinational corporation. One of the key doctrines, it seems to me, in the American corporate culture is that there always must be growth. Is this attitude that unlimited growth must continue one that needs to change if we're going to have a sustainable planet?
Well, Peter, I think that's an excellent question. I think in the 21st century, the civil society is going to have to become more involved in the environmental decisions and environmental policies. And for that to happen, for the kind of changes that you were speaking of at the beginning, which really came about because of the civil society wanted those changes, like in the Berlin Wall and so forth, for those changes to happen, we're going to have two things. We're going to have economic stability, a continued economic stability, and that's going to have to be on a global basis. But we're also going to have a path of environmental improvement. And those two things must not be seen as in opposition, because if they are seen in opposition, then we aren't going to make the progress, particularly at the state and local and local levels and at the individual level, because people want economic well-being. So I think it's important that we see that both economic stability, not necessarily growth, but economic stability and environmental progress are quality of life factors.
Well, Mary Lou Reed from Idaho, this notion of unlimited growth forever, is that an attitude that, in your judgment, we can continue to live with?
We can continue to live with it, Peter, but I think it's one that's tremendously difficult to alter. I mean, we have the broad open spaces, and it looks as if the sky is indeed the limit. And I think we have so many past situations like the mining and all the extractive industries have held the legislatures in captive for so many years that their attitudes are going to have to change, and the public is going to have to assume more responsibility. But I think, and chambers of commerce are going to have to change their attitude that growth is forever on the horizon.
Now, Joan Davidson, you have been engaged in urban affairs for many years, particularly in New York, where growth to some degree, at least in Manhattan, is limited by the fact that it's an island. Does this whole growth idea require some modification if we're going to make cities go in the future?
Yeah, it certainly does, and I think it is actually underway. I think there is a growing movement to slow growth down or to make it sensible instead of mindless. But I just wanted to say that I think I am in high hopes that with the new Congress, the poisonous atmosphere will subside a little bit, because unless we can have really cooperation and bipartisan action in this country, ain't nothing going to improve for the environment or anything else. So I think that's the first thing that has to change, a sense of everybody working for the common good. I think the things that are helping slow down mindless growth are really coming from all quarters. I think it's partly to save the land and to save farmland, which of course is the food supply around cities. And people have realized, you know, if you let your farmland be devoured by development, there goes that resource. And I think people realize that cities are better when they're sort of contained and compressed and concentrated, because that makes them more like cities instead of spreading out all over the landscape. So people want to condense their cities and make them better and more prosperous. People want to save the open land and farmland. And then I think the other sort of miscellaneous group of people are realizing how expensive it is constantly to be building new habitats in the countryside when it's much more economical to start with what you have and
I must say that a couple of things I think that are encouraging have happened in the last year, and that is increasingly some of the big environmental organizations, with some push from people like the Turner Foundation and others, are saying we've really got to look at sprawl much more comprehensively.
And also the whole preservation movement is joining with the environmental people, I think, on that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. No, it's great.
I certainly agree with Joan that we have to be concerned about the whole issue of Congress. I think it's absolutely unbelievable that we now have a Congress that opposes family planning.
Yeah.
around the world if any dollars are going to be used for abortions.
Exactly.
So we do not talk enough about population growth, I believe. We talk a lot about sprawl, but we also need to be concerned about smaller families.
Mary Lou, let me ask you something about that, because obviously when we're talking about population and other things, we're talking about natural resources. And you come from a part of the country, Idaho, where the capturing of natural resources and putting them into the commercial scheme of things has been what drives the country. Are those attitudes going to have to change, approach to natural resources?
They have to change. The question of limits has to be one that can be expected. But how that's going to change, I don't know, because all of the extractive industries really frighten their employees that they're in danger of losing their jobs if there are any changes to the current practices, if there are any limitations put on. And I think that most loggers believe there are plenty of trees. Most fishermen believe there are plenty of fish. So there is a tremendous educational effort that has to take place, and it has to have the support of the media, the newspapers, the TV, and the general elected officials. And so far, we do not see very much of that in the West.
John Plout, let me ask John something for just a moment. John, do you see on the industry side of things, on the business side of things, any possibility of a perhaps less exploitive approach to natural resources, or a more sustainable one?
Well, sure. And I'd like to give an example of one, which is another one to add to your list, where such a thing has happened. And then I'd like to just quickly mention one that's facing us now where it hasn't happened. The one where it's happened is in the introduction of unleaded gas for cars, which has happened over the last a little over a decade now. And which is to introduce that word technology, which is a change in technology, which has resulted in cleaner air everywhere where it has been adopted, and that is an area where technology has limited what we do, but in a very, very positive way. But to bring some reality back to the discussion, too, I have to say, as someone who lives right outside of New York City, that the crisis that New York City faces in terms of what it's going to do with its garbage, which is generated by millions of people, is not solved. And is a problem from the highest level, the federal level, all the way down to the individual person within the city. And so far, the solutions have not been acceptable to various aspects of the population. So we have not been
shipping it to Virginia, which is now what's happening.
Yeah, or like putting it out in the ocean, which was happening at one time, which certainly was not acceptable. So we have to. There are problems. Problems that we are doing well in solving, and then there are problems that we're not doing so well in solving.
Well, let's move from New York for a moment. Again, I'd like to go back to you, Joan, as one who has been so concerned about cities. What have we got to say to people that run cities and the people who live in them and everybody else that thinks they're bad places that they want to stay away from about the future of the American city? What are the attitudes that we have to change to make these things work and continue to be the center of culture and vibrancy that those of us from New York know that they are?
Well, yeah, of course. My own view is that, there are two sides of the same coin. You want to keep open land open, and you want to keep cities thriving. Cities, and they go together, I think. They're two sides of the same coin. But cities are the, as we know, look at New York as the ultimate center of commerce, of finance, of media, of the arts. I mean, the whole computer world that's taken us over, of course, was born there and thrives there still. That doesn't mean other cities aren't equally great in their own way. I just happen to know and love New York. I think one comes back always to the need for government policy here. I mean, I think we have to do something about transportation. There should be much more emphasis on mass transit than on building roads.
I'm into that.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I don't know how we get that change. That's been an insuperable obstacle for generations. I don't know how. I think there's a major effort in New York now going on to salvage the waterfront. Here we are, an island, and in so many places, you know, people live and die and never see the river. And so there's a major effort going forward to reclaim the rivers and the waterfront, and I think that's fabulous, and that could use public help and private help, and it's getting it now.
Again, in terms of public attitudes, my recollection is the last politician that tried to go across the country and say, we need an urban policy, was John Lindsay when he was mayor, and he didn't get very far with that.
Yeah.
Now, Mary Lou Reed, you come from Idaho, and I'm sure that a lot of the folk that you represented when you were in the state Senate out there thought places like New York or Chicago or San Francisco
were close
to hell themselves.
I say that as someone who loves New York
exactly.
myself.
So how do we go about dealing with an attitude in the country that will generate urban policies that make sense for everybody? What do you say to your former constituents on that issue?
Well, my former constituents actually were more urban than rural, and so I was always trying to convince them that they should be asserting themselves, that even in a rural state, there are many urban centers, and that the policies that are going to be healthy for the state are those that are going to be promoting sound policies that relate to population centers. So I think you find that everywhere. The problem, I think, continues to be convincing people that change is possible and is admirable. People just sort of assume that things are going to be the same tomorrow as they were today. So how we get people to work together to assume responsibility is the big, it continues to be the major question mark.
Oh, excuse me, but
sure.
I wonder, Peter, if maybe the new way of thinking we have to adopt is to think in bigger chunks, more regionally. I think a lot of trouble is created because states compete with each other. You know, everybody wants the biggest highways and the biggest cities and the biggest this's and that's ports and so on, whereas perhaps if we could think regionally and decide where these facilities will be that benefit everybody and don't require duplicating things and ever more building.
And isn't that a pretty tough sell politically? You can run for governor by we're going to make our state the best, and this whole notion of regional cooperation, again, is an attitude that has not prevailed in the American political process.
But you said what we need to change, and I think that's
right.
Well,
John Plout.
And along that line, maybe with the change of the Congress now, and perhaps events will get a little more positive now in the federal bureaucracy in the federal Congress, we can say that the original concept of the Lockean idea that one gives up something to in order to get one's rights for the public good is going to have to take hold in the 21st century.
And I would argue that perhaps is our greatest challenge. We see it with the private property rights folk who tend to think that there is no community interest, there's only private. So perhaps one of our biggest challenges in the next year is to see this notion of communal responsibility is an attitude that gets reinculcated in the process.
Maybe also individuals, Peter, have to there's so much of me first in our society and in our culture, and that me first has to change.
Well, hard times will maybe make it come back.
Well, I hope we don't have that.
We're just too rich at the moment. And I would say, Peter, that I would like to see change coming in support. I mean, massive support for wonderful efforts that are now underway, like, for instance, the land trust movement, I think, is sort of the fastest growing corner of the environmental movement at this moment. I think it's fabulous because it's essentially inspired by private people using private money, and yet it is accomplishing public goals.
Great. And on that, you know, I'm afraid our time is up.
No,
terrible.
I say that Nature Conservancy is doing well in the
yes.
West.
Yes. Right. Well, my guests have been Environment Show Advisory Board members Mary Lou Reed, former state senator from Idaho, Jonathan Plout, former director of environmental quality for Allied Signal, and Joan Davidson, former New York State Commissioner of the Parks and Historic Preservation. We'd like to hear your views about some of the ideas we've been kicking around here. Give us a call. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. We've been talking green, and I'm Peter Burley. You can hear The Environment Show anytime on our website. It's www.enn.com/envshow. That's www.enn.com/envshow. You can also send us a message about what you've been hearing. This is Green Tips, tips on how you can save the world in your everyday life. If you live in an old home, the local energy company may offer to put a water-saving head in your shower for free. This saves both water and energy used to heat it. If you live in a newer home, it may be installed already. But if you're like most of us, you probably don't know how much water you're getting or whether you can do with just a little less. One way to find out is to dump a gallon of water in a bucket and mark the level on the side of the pail. Empty it and put it under your shower, flowing at the rate you use when you bathe. It should take 24 seconds for the bucket to fill to the 1 gallon mark. If it takes less, you're getting a higher flow than the 2.5 gallons per minute set by the National Energy Act. You can solve the problem by replacing the shower head, or simply give up taking showers. Now you really don't have to listen to The Environment Show to figure that out. That's our green tip for this week. In coming weeks, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency is expected to announce new regulations for light trucks and the widely popular sport utility vehicles. This comes on the heels of aggressive steps recently taken in California to reduce the amount of pollutants emitted by these vehicles. The Environment Show's Stephen Westcott has more.
Last November, California's Air Resources Board adopted a rule requiring light trucks and SUVs under 8,500 pounds to meet the same emission standards as passenger cars.
Yeah, the California regulations phase in starting in 2004 and are not fully phased in until 2007. This means that the auto companies have 8 years to comply with those regulations. That's plenty of time for them to improve the technology and meet these new standards.
That's Roland Wong, Transportation Program Director for the environmental group Union of Concerned Scientists. Based in California, he has been following the latest efforts by the state to reduce light truck emissions. Wong says California officials found automakers can meet the new standards with minimal effort.
The ARB staff, using practically off-the-shelf technology, just improved catalyst and some minor modifications to the engine, are able to meet the standards using vehicles that are currently on the market with just minor enhancements. They are able to meet the standards today, those vehicles, and the cost is in the neighborhood of $200. The auto companies would like you to believe that the cost will be somewhere in the neighborhood of $9,000 per vehicle and that you will some of these vehicles won't be even on the market anymore if they're held the same standards as cars. That's just not the case.
Wong says automakers unsuccessfully fought the recent regulations and emphasizes it is the same reluctance manufacturers exhibited when it came to installing seat belts and airbags. But Diane Steed believes that is an overgeneralization. Steed is president of the Coalition for Vehicle Choice, an organization that represents the interests of vehicle users and others, such as the American Farm Bureau, insurance companies, as well as automakers. Steed says while American car companies have disagreed with implementation schedules in the past, they have also asked for regulations on a number of occasions. In addition, Steed is concerned that California's new regulations will limit the kinds of cars and trucks people can buy and drive. But now the organization is focusing its attention on what the Environmental Protection Agency is calling its Tier 2 standards.
Kind of the next step in the Clean Air Act, and we understand that they may very well follow California's lead, if not entirely, at least in part. And we are concerned that they would apply passenger car emission standards to light trucks nationwide.
Environmentalists, on the other hand, fear auto manufacturers will avoid the restrictions by simply building vehicles that weigh more than 8,500 pounds. Meanwhile, Steed is hoping the EPA will look at the whole picture of vehicle emissions, including the role gasoline plays in reducing air quality. EPA officials are not discussing the specifics of the agency's plans, but it is also expected to require oil companies to sell low-sulfur fuel, a step already taken by California. It's believed high sulfur levels in gasoline degrades air quality. Again, Roland Wong of Union of Concerned Scientists.
We are lucky here in California that we have got aggressive regulations for gasoline, which dramatically reduces the sulfur content. That's not the case nationwide. The high sulfur levels in gasoline effectively mask the performance of the catalyst and renders it essentially ineffective. If we don't reduce the sulfur in gasoline, we cannot reduce the tailpipe emissions from cars and light trucks. Extremely critical that EPA tackle this problem. Unfortunately, from their perspective, it means they have to tackle almost simultaneously two of the largest industries in the U.S.
Oil companies have offered to cut sulfur levels, but only in eastern states where smog is a problem. Additionally, industry officials say reducing sulfur levels would force them to make refinery improvements and add a nickel to the price of gasoline. However, this probably would not deter SU-crazed Americans from buying all-terrain 4x4s. Today, as many light trucks and SUVs are being sold as automobiles. Some fear this trend may counteract anticipated improvements in air quality resulting from the Clean Air Act. Diane Steed says most Americans buy SUVs for the safety and towing capacity they offer. She is concerned that new federal guidelines will limit consumer choice.
In 1978, 68% of domestic car models could tow 2,100 pounds or more. That's not a very heavy load. That's kind of the average bass boat out there. And as fuel economy standards got ever stricter by about, the mid-1980s, only about 20% of those vehicles could tow 2,100 pounds. Today, only about 60% of passenger car models can tow a one-ton load. So, as you can see, regulations can, in fact, affect the kinds of vehicles we buy and drive. So I think our fears are proven out by history.
This year, Congress is expected to begin a reexamination of the Clean Air Act. But first, EPA will announce new regulations for SUV emissions. What sort of compromise the agency makes between the oil and auto industries and states suffering from poor air quality remains to be seen. For the Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
Thanks for being with us in this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Berlin. If you want to pick pecans on the planet of a nearby star, listen to the program again and find out how. Call 1-800-323-9262
and order show number 471. The Environment Show is a national production which is solely responsible for its content. Alan Chartok is executive producer, Stephen Westcott is producer, and Ray Graff is audio engineer. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the William Bingham Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. www.hemmings.com. Be good to the Earth, and join us next week for The Environment Show.